This is The Conversation. It's episode 148 with Alicia Eller, arts writer and entertainment writer. This is a very entertainment adjacent heavy episode, so I don't know whether to excite you with that or warn you, but we talk a lot about, in addition to art and performance art, we talk about entertainment, comedy, the reality show, which I'm always tempted to call Art Star, but is actually called Work of Art. I think it's still going. She has a couple of buddies who are on the first couple seasons, and we talk about her experience with Tinder as well. That's pretty art adjacent. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com. And I invite you to take our survey, if you would be so kind to just spend a couple of minutes, go to theconversationpod.com/survey. Just take a couple of minutes to fill out that, if only 7, 8, 9, I believe. Taking the survey really will help us with our future programming and expansion, so that would be greatly appreciated. And also, could you be so kind as to subscribe to the show? You can do that through the website. You can also do it on the major platforms, iTunes ideally, as well as Stitcher, by going to The Conversation, an artist podcast, the original title of the show. And subscribe, and you know, you don't have to listen to every episode, but you're subscribed and that helps us quite a bit. So that would be greatly appreciated. So let's hear what Alicia has to say about art, stand-up comedy, performance. Hear a little bit from Maria Bamford, one of my favorite comedians. And so much more, including Tinder. Thank you so much for being here. Stick around for the back end, and I will talk to you then. As you may know, one of my, if not my favorite place to start out, is locating you in the world. So you're on the other side of town from me in Highland Park, right?
I am. I'm in Highland Park, just off on the York side.
The York side. And how long have you been in Highland Park?
You know, I've been here about 2 years.
Okay, so pretty fresh.
I've lived in this place about 2 years. It'll be 2 years in September.
Mm-hmm. And where do you see yourself in the evolution of the neighborhood as far as gentrification and whatnot?
Well, I actually live in, I don't know if you've heard of the gallery adjunct positions.
No, tell me.
No? Oh, okay. They were just mentioned in the New York Times, which is pretty cool. And that, so my roommate David Prince and his sister Anya own the house. And one of the ideas for the house is, you know, why David wanted to invest. And he's also from, he grew up in Pasadena, South Pass. He went to SAIC in Chicago, and, you know, Michelle Grabner has her space as suburban. And he really liked that setup of like a art gallery, like a high quality art gallery, but like artists running in or next to one's home,
mm-hmm.
like on the property. So inside the place, we have like a strip of white wall and white floor. That's the gallery. And then there's like an outdoor space too in the, what would be the garage.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they bought this house like 5 or 6 years ago. It was a foreclosure. And I moved in 2 years ago. He was still building out the interior gallery space. And, you know, it's, you know, we got the Berry Bowl at York and 51. We just recently got that juice bar. We've got, like, a new bar. So, I mean, just in the 2 years I've been here, I've seen it, you know, just kind of more stores that are really specialty and, depending on who you ask, useless.
uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, my rent hasn't changed. I'm really grateful for that, but you know, it's
those two are your landlords, right?
I'm not sure what to say.
But those two are your landlords.
Yes.
Yeah, so they're obviously tenant friendly, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, I think it's very different. I mean, it's completely different than if I, you know, I was renting from a property company. So it has a very like, I think I'm lucky to not have, you know, the, oh shit, rent's going to go out and I'm going to be out of here and my landlord doesn't even know my name.
Right.
You know, it's
right.
Very, it feels very much like a community, which I think is part of why I've stayed here for as long as I have.
And just to go back to the beginning, so they have an artist-run space that's basically taken over the garage there?
the garage, and then inside, like on the other side of the wall of my room. Mm-hmm. I could send you pictures too.
Yeah.
If you want some pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's in, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it's a living space in that you, we, I mean, I walk through the interior version of the gallery every day. When we have openings, it's kind of like if someone's in the kitchen making something, like, oh, is that part of the performance? You know, those
right.
situations. And yeah, David, he's able to have a lot of creative and curatorial freedom. At one point, he ran the space with our friend Sarah Schnatt, who has since moved to the Bay Area. Yeah, but it's really, you know, it's, I'm actually not involved in the running of the space because I felt like it would be sort of a conflict of interest given my art journalism, but mm-hmm. also it just was a time commitment I couldn't really make. But yeah, it's nice, you know, having, even if I don't go out to that many shows, there's always something on deck here or just a great conversation with David, you know, who's across the hall.
So you're basically living in a place where the art kind of comes to you, which is pretty convenient.
Oftentimes, yes. And actually, when I first moved here, I was the adjunct positions writer in residence. So we had a little office set up for me in the garage part. This is before the interior part of adjunct positions was built. And that convinced, you know, it's turned into a permanent writer in residence. Or I'm now the writer in residence, not writer in residency. The residency ended and I became a permanent fixture.
Right.
Yeah.
What did that entail? Does that mean that you were going to write all the press releases or something more complicated?
Oh, no,
that?
No. For my own writing.
Oh, like, I see. So you're like an extension of the gallery.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, hey, this would make it more fun. And I had been in LA for maybe like 8 or 9 months, and I was still sort of confused about what is LA, which I feel like, I don't know. I moved here from Chicago, I guess now almost 3 years ago. And I was just like, what is this place? So I spent a lot of time thinking about LA and, you know, I got books like City of Quartz and Chris Krause's Video Green, and then that big literary anthology Writing Los Angeles, which I didn't finish any of them. You know, watch Steve Martin's movie.
LA Story.
Oh, shit.
LA Story.
LA Story. Yeah, and I was just, like, trying to understand, and I was, like, really kind of overwhelmed by how much influence the entertainment industry has. Coming from Chicago, which Chicago is like, you know, a theater and food town. Like, there's some art, you know, there are actors and whatever, but it's just, you know, much larger scale here. So as a culture writer, you know, I originally moved here to cover art, the visual, you know, what was going on in LA, and I just became fascinated with LA. So that was the writer in residency. I was just writing about, you know, thoughts and feelings about LA, and then it culminated in a short stand-up show.
Oh, really?
Comedy, which I hadn't done in a while. Yeah.
So you had done some stand-up, and then you revived it for this culmination.
I had done some stand-up in Chicago with this really awesome dude, Shaq Standley, who's now in New York. He was like one of the last contestants on Last Comic Standing
mm-hmm.
before they ended that show. And he's great. We did some comedy together. We met at an open mic in Chicago. So I was like, I don't know how to deal with this. I didn't want to write like memoir or short fiction. I was just like, this is hilarious. Like, I just felt so confused that it was comical.
What was an example of a bit from that piece or show?
I mean, let's see. It's, I was working on some joke that, you know, I hadn't written stand up in a while. So I was sort of like, I would get to the build up, but like lack the punchline. So something about like, you know, I was thinking about friends with, you know, the phrase friends with benefits. And I was like still making a lot of friends here. And I was like, thinking about friends with friend benefits and like what's a friend benefit. They were kind of meandering. Like I ended up taking a stand-up class later that helped me get to the punchline. Yeah, so I was like, what's a friend benefit? And, you know, how do you, you know, and then I think I got to a punchline about, I was like, you know, I made this new friend and he's really great. And, you know, the friend benefits are awesome. And I'm able to offer them as well. And then I slowly learned that he offered these benefits to all of his friends. And I don't know if I'm okay with that. And it was going somewhere toward that. Like, so yeah, that was, I didn't get a lot of laughs, you know, it's okay.
Was it an alternative comedy type of venue where it could be, you know, you wouldn't have to be as dependent on the punchlines as you would otherwise?
I mean, the venue was our backyard, because we have a backyard porch. So I just invited some people I was either becoming friends with or hoping to become better friends with. And I was like, hey, I'm available. I have friend benefits. You know, these are my friend benefits. So it was sort of like, I was just feeling a little socially confused. So where that went.
When you mentioned earlier, it seemed, you know, coming from Chicago and to hear that it seemed all like, what you said, something and entertainment. Or did you just say it all seemed like the entertainment industry?
Oh, there is just so much entertainment industry.
Right. It made me think of the artist, the performance artist you did an interview with, who I wasn't familiar with, Jibs Cameron, a.k.a. Dynasty Handbag.
Yeah.
Who I'll let you tell us about as a performer since you've seen her perform, but... well, why don't I let you do that first, and then I'll get to my point about what made me think of her. Because you saw her perform at El Cid. Is that where you saw her, or you saw her a few different places?
I had always known of her. Mm-hmm. And let's see. And I saw her. She has a show called Weirdo Night. It's second Sunday of every month at El Cid on Sunset, and it's just like a... You know, it's her and then two or three other comic / visual performance artists that are funny. And then I also saw her show at Red Cat. She did the show Homo, the Soggy Glasses : A Homo's Odyssey, which is just so funny. And just, it's about her journey. You know, she had all these ideas about what would be awesome as an artist. And she goes to this residency after being sort of like lost in the subway. It's like a surreal piece. And then she gets this residency and it's awful and she's attacked by a hawk. And, you know, it's not, you know, every artist has that dream of like, I'm going to get to nature and be out there. And all of a sudden I'll be struck inspired. And then instead it's like, actually, no, I'm just going to read a bunch of mystery novels. And, I don't work well in isolation. Oh, you know,
uh-huh.
I imagine that would happen to me too if I tried to do that, because I really like to be around people a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel inspired when I'm alone. I just feel crazed and just really in my head.
Right.
So, yeah. So that was part of what that performance was about.
As a performer, she has sort of campy / kind of putting this sort of vulnerable persona out there, basically, is kind of what I took mm-hmm. from what you described. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like a really interesting idea that she was representing, you know, sort of these failed vulnerable types, or her character was a sort of failed vulnerable type, and she was really putting it out there and kind of embarrassing herself and whatnot. And you know, and you can talk maybe more about that, but what sort of made me shift in my perception of her and her endeavors was when it got to the transitioned into the fact that she was also a TV writer, essentially, or aspiring TV writer, and, you know, had this project in the works. And I want to make it clear that I honor, you know, that when you're a performance artist, you need to have, you know, ways to survive that are not based on your performance art. But it's just interesting, and it goes back to when you mentioned how it all seemed like entertainment out here. Here you have this performance artist, you know, who's very much kind of a hybrid of a you know, high art, fine art performance artist and, you know, an entertainer.
Yeah, that's a really apt for just assessment of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I know she moved out here because of this TV opportunity, and it is. I mean, I know in the art world there is this sort of like, oh well, if you're a performance artist, it's sort of assumed you don't really make much money, and that sucks. Unless you're, you know, teaching odd jobs, and then
right.
probably your work, you don't earn that much from it. But like, there's like a certain sort of, digestibility that I think most comedy on TV has, or just like TV in general. Like, you have to be able to digest it and has to hold your attention in a way that art doesn't ask that of the viewer.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also all in favor of her getting a show and, you know, striking it rich if that's what she wants, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or just getting a show and not striking it rich. You know, we don't know. I think there's just overall just, it's so hard as an artist or as a writer just to make money off of that. Like, I'm in a situation now where I'm not earning enough from my arts and culture journalism, not because I am not a good writer, but because the market is just so terrible.
Sure.
Like, it's really upsetting, and I've had a lot of conversations about this lately, you know, and it's, I don't know that, I mean, if I've seen theater writers, you know, move here to get into TV because there's more opportunity, but that also requires something of a compromise in the way one writes and thinks. Like, it's just consumable. It's more quickly consumed, and I think you don't get to explore as much. But as an artist or writer, I think it's also nice to challenge yourself with different formats and mediums and,
mm-hmm.
and just sort of figure out, like, oh, can I move fluidly between these, or do I have to pick one or the other, or sort of what's the, not that it's a compromise, but sort of like, what's the ideal way to live and work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and
as
I think...
As a creative person.
And I think as consumers or viewers of, or just being aware of performance art and performance artists, that it's kind of a new paradigm to accept, you know, that they're people who need to maybe get outside of the art world and its limited resources, and that in this case and probably a lot of other cases involves being acquainted or entwined with the entertainment world as well, you know. So all that to say that, you know, there's something initially to me and probably many people, you know, who are acquainted with performance art is sort of dirtying about or tainted about the entertainment umbrella,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
over that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's something that obviously I think the way that you sort of implied it is something that we need to kind of get over and adapt to.
Oh, yeah. And I love how you brought it back around to just sort of my initial observations about LA and just how everything felt about entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not useful to have such strict, like, this is art and this is not. I just think it's a different expression. You know, it's just like, do you want to experiment with that? And can you? And, you know, maybe do you need to? I know I've become really fascinated with TV. I don't know. I've never written in that format. I've heard a lot of playwrights say that it's very hard to transition from playwriting to TV and film, screenwriting,
mm-hmm,
essentially.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like more comedians I've met have an easier time with TV because they're used to, you know, in TV writing, there's just, you constantly have to keep the energy high or just keep, you know, moving pretty fast. And half the job of the stand-up comedian is just to punch up jokes and make sure they, like, hit, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's an easier transition for a stand-up comedian to do TV comedy writing if they're a writer, more of a writer than just a comic, you know?
Yeah.
So that makes sense. Initially when I moved here, I was like, oh, well, I'm noticing so much entertainment stuff. I'll think about this and maybe I'll do some of it. And then it'll, you know, what I love about the art world and people, you know, performance artists who are working with the tropes of stand-up comedy are funny, but it's not about becoming a comedian. You can think more about the structure and the form,
right?
Than the you know, then having the pressure of, like, I got to land this joke.
Yeah.
So there is that sort of freedom that I think that you get in the art world. Like, I wrote a piece for Hyperallergic a couple of years, maybe it was a year ago now. It was performance artists use stand-up tropes, but not for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at performance artists specifically who would take certain elements of comedians, the stand-up comedian's performance, and like integrate into theirs, but more to comment on the role of the stand-up comedian than to make jokes that would land.
Right.
The brick wall. You know, this this performance artist's name? There was a show about the same topic at the San Diego Museum of Art. Keisha Futakowski has a piece called Smile, and another one called Camouflage, and the pieces are comical, and some of them are just commenting on comedians.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, and like thinking about artists in relation to like Andy Kaufman and that, you know, he was such a comedian / performance artist, and
yeah.
You know, he would go on shows, and it was unclear if this was him or if this was like just part of what, you know, what his persona.
He was the ultimate crossover, you know, performance artist, comedian. Yeah.
Yes.
Let me go back to when you were sort of at the beginning, when we were talking about your home and adjacent artist-run gallery. And we were talking about, you know, our sort of ongoing theme is entertainment / art, you know, and whatnot. And I was wondering if you know of or can think of any artists or other people in the art world other than performance artists that have any kind of crossover with the entertainment industry. Because I think of artists as, even if they're not necessarily doing something pure, quote unquote, which, you know, who knows what even that means, but that there's, you know, there's the occasional artist that will maybe do, I don't know, set work or something like that. But, you know, you don't see a lot of artists who are screenwriters, you know, for example.
Right. No, that's exactly true. Yeah, that's, I mean, you have Cindy Sherman who did the movie.
Office Killer.
Office Killer.
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
that was not a box office hit. I was at that shoot.
For good reason, I will tell you, as somebody who's seen it. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, it doesn't capture you in the way that a good movie does. yeah, it was funny. I saw the show. I went to the press preview, and then I was texting with a friend of mine, Peregrine Honig. And I was like, oh, I just saw, she was on that reality show, Work of Art. I think that's how some people know her. But I was like, oh, I saw Cindy Sherman's, you know, film, and I was trying to like talk to her about it. And she's like, she's an artist, like not a screenwriter. And I was like, oh, but you know, isn't it great when artists like tried new things? And she was like, yeah, it is. But like that, she's an artist, you know? And I mean, that was, she didn't continue making films after that. That was her one film.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a different sensibility. I was at a party the other day, and I was talking with this guy who teaches at UCLA, and he was saying he, you know, he's gone out. He tends to end up dating lawyers or other academics, but not like actors or people in entertainment. And I think it's hard. There's not that much crossover because one is probably thinking about the structure of it, and the other one is just trying to like make it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's, I guess there's, you know, a couple comedians though that the art people tend to love, like Maria Bamford,
yeah,
and Kate Berlant, because they are a bit more, I think, surreal in their humor. Like
yeah.
It's not so like, just like, you know, delivery or, you know, you don't, I guess they're coming at it from a different sort of perspective that reads as more thoughtful to the art world, but. Yeah, I don't know. I had this idea that there would be a ton of crossover, and there's really not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Also, you know, moving here, I've ended up interviewing quite a few, you know, I mean, famous people, and that was a surprise to me. Like, I interviewed Steve Martin, Miranda July, and I talked to Sarah Silverman, and, you know, these are, and Maria Bamford as well, Lauren Lapkus, Kate Berlant, and John Early, Fred.
These are all comedians, right?
Fred Melamed.
These are
all
comedians.
Actors and comedians.
Yeah.
Yeah, except for Miranda July, but.
Right. Who's an actor, though?
You know, I had to sort of, what's that?
I said, who is an actor, though, of sorts?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, definitely. She is.
Yeah.
She is an actor.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's been interesting to interview actors and comedians. It's such a different process than with artists. With artists, it seems to be like a lot more internal, and you sort of like get more into the ideas of things. And then with actors and comedians, it's more like you're talking about what it is. Like there's like, it feels more like in the present moment, if that makes sense, and less in thought and theory.
Well, you know, it's funny. What you're describing actually parallels almost perfectly kind of how I feel having podcast conversations with artists versus with writers, you know, because the way I sort of describe it is when I talk to artists, it's kind of like we're going inward, we're going into their world, whereas with writers, we kind of talk about everything.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, unless it's a fiction writer.
Yes, I haven't talked to any fiction writers yet. So, when you mentioned your friend who was on the Art Star reality show, which I've never seen, for the record, by the way, but what it made me think of is the fact that from what I've seen of your writing, you seem to be, one of your specialties seems to be technology and art, you know, or just, you know, the new language of culture and these kinds of things. And so I wonder if what your kind of take is on people that, you know, maybe generally that show, but more specifically kind of people who have been on that show or just artists who are working in that kind of crossover mainstream / art kind of culture border.
Sure. So that show ran for 2 seasons, Work of Art, The Next Great Artist. And my friend Peregrine Honig was on the first season, and she ended up getting second place. And then my friend Young Sun Han was on the second season, and he got second place too. So
consistent.
That was strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was interesting to see how they approached it differently. Peregrine really, you know, was like, okay, I'm in this show. It's a performance, and she does works that are performative as well. And she's like a very striking, just individual as a person. Like you know, she's really like, more social than a lot of artists.
Yeah.
She's probably in contact with, you know,
she's probably very charismatic, I would imagine,
runs
too.
Runs her own business. Very charismatic.
Yeah.
Yes. Very charming.
Right.
She's a delight. We have matching tattoos. Love her. And she approached it as, okay, I want to learn about the way that this show is created as a reality TV show. So she was very aware of her role in the show and the moments when they were like trying to instigate drama. And so she was aware of those sorts of like emotionally manipulative techniques.
Mm.
And she is just really, she can really just block it out or just not engage, or she can decide to. So I feel like she's very controlled and aware in the way she approached that show and just,
right.
I mean, in her world. And, but she didn't spend a lot of time studying reality TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was like, I'm going to be vulnerable on this show, but I'm going to also be aware of when they're manipulating me to be this way. You
right.
know, like the way there are a couple parts in the show where they just like got a couple of the characters to fight. There was an episode, I think it was the seventh or eighth episode, where she was partnered with this just really terrible artist who was like, all right, you know, they were supposed to make something, and he was like, great, so I'm a photographer, I photograph naked women, so, you know, take off your clothes, I'm going to photograph you. And she was like, absolutely not. You're going to take off your clothes. And he was like, she got him to do that, which was amazing.
Wow.
And I think they won the challenge. And she, you know, she was able to sort of like flip the script in that way. And he, for whatever reason, went along with it, because she was just like, I'm just not participating in that sort of a dynamic. And no is no. You know, no is a complete sentence.
Do you think if I could just interject, do you think that she, as far as being aware of the manipulation, you know, and the strategizing of the producers, that she decided for the most part that she would go against that grain, or basically she would strategize so that she would either go with it or against it depending on the moment?
I mean, I think she was just very aware in the moment, and that was just something she wasn't going to do.
So not give in other words.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't mean, I don't mean that particular anecdote you're referring to. I just meant overall on the show. In other words, like if she was in a particular moment where the producers were manipulating the contestants to, you know, act out or whatever, that she's like, I'm not having any part of this.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to exactly what she was thinking, but I just know that she had watched enough reality TV and was aware of what she was available for that, you know, like, oh, okay. This is a situation where it's being manipulated. And I know she approached the show more like a marathon than a race,
mm-hmm.
you know? So like, if you want to finish the marathon, you have to go slowly, you know, you can't just like race through the first 5 miles and then you're exhausted. You know,
yeah.
She was just like slow and steady wins the race. And that's just been one of her mottos that's really inspired me. Just like, you know, take your time and easy does it and slow and steady rather than like rush in. You know, that's like a real path to burnout in my experience.
Do you know
throwing yourself into anything really?
Do you know what her takeaway and or sort of bump was from being on that show?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it was very exciting. People would just recognize her on the street. So you have that sort of like celebrity quality of like, oh, I know you from somewhere. That happened to her a lot. Or people would be like, I know you from the show.
Mm-hmm.
So just like having that was like a very surreal experience, knowing that you were being seen by just so many people. And we talked about that a lot. And then, yeah, I mean, certainly like she sold more work and got more visibility. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it was a win for her to do that show.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was a similar situation with my friend Young, who, you know, he got just more visibility and sold more work. He studied reality TV more before the show, so he was like, I think that actually was to his detriment because he was just like so aware
mm-hmm.
of like the structure of it and maybe that took him out of like the emotional space of it because you're so aware of the structure. So how to like be aware of the structure but stay really emotionally engaged because that is your reality for however long it takes to tape the show, I think a month and a half.
Mm.
Yeah, so I guess that was the first instance of like crossover that I was really engaged with. And that was in Chicago, like maybe 2008 or so. I was like, wow, I was really appalled by it, but I was also really excited that there was, you know, this possibility that art and entertainment could coalesce for at least a time. And I recall, you know, talking to friends who were just really like, oh, this is the dumbest thing. And, you know, sort of like reinforcing this idea that the two couldn't ever come together. And I think there's like, it's kind of like a Venn diagram where there's like this small space in the middle where they overlap and then they're pretty much separate otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I know here in LA, I've had more personal experiences with entertainment stuff just through like dating women who are involved in that industry. And then that's like the Venn diagram of like, yeah, I'm not trying to be a TV writer, but oh, I'm now dating a TV writer, you know, or like, I'm not trying to be a comedian, really. I really like comedy and like, oh, now I'm out with a comedian, you know? So
mm-hmm.
That's more specific to my, you know, just dating as a gay woman.
It sounds like you would have watched the show even if these two friends of yours hadn't been on, as based on what you just said earlier about that you were both kind of excited and appalled at the same time.
I think so. I mean, today I definitely would watch the show whether or not my friends were on it. I think Alicia from 5 years ago would have still been a little bit like pretentious about the situation.
Right.
Like, no, this is like, there's something wrong with this.
I think I'm still pretentious about the situation, and I probably always will be, if that's the word. It probably
sure.
isn't the word, but yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't know. I mean, I think maybe you can, and maybe you can set me straight on this. I think probably my biggest concern, and I think a lot of people, I would imagine a lot of people listening's biggest concern, is that the face of being an artist that's being put up for the masses to see is, you know, nothing anywhere close to what it is, and that feels a little embarrassing. So maybe that's kind of the sentiment.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that I agree with that. I mean, of course, like that's not the whole, you know, that's not the artist's probably best representation of them. I mean, I don't know. I've watched this PBS Art 21 series, like Spotlight on the Artist.
Sure.
It's very much like from, you know, those are beautiful. And I've edited a couple issues of Art 21 magazine, and yeah, it's very much like a thoughtful, slow approach to talking about the art and the artist, and less about like who they are and why they started making art, and more about the art itself, you know?
Yeah.
I think stuff that's made for TV or made for like, I tend to not go into biographical stuff as much as in art journalism as I do in like the entertainment journalism I've done. Like, that's what people are more interested in people, you know, and unless you're like really interested in specifically art, you're not going to spend an hour watching a PBS thing unless you really love the art. And if you learn a little bit about the artist, that's cool. But in that way, art is less personal. There's something impersonal to the art world that I think would never work in comedy and entertainment. Like, you want to know about the actor. You want to know where they came from and just connect with them, because all they're doing on screen is portraying another person.
Yeah.
You know, it's just about people and emotions, whereas art is less about other people, somewhat effective about emotions, but mostly about whatever the conceptual thing is, or something that's thoughtful or makes you think about an idea. So
yeah.
I feel like that's the big divide. I guess the one thing I've really found from checking out both worlds is I have so much respect for how hard it is to write jokes. Like, it's really fun. I like writing jokes when I'm in that space, but it's a really different mental space as a writer. And it's also like, it's hard, because something that's funny to you and a couple people, how do you frame that as something that's going to like make a group of people laugh? Like,
yeah.
It's just structuring. It's just like thinking about humor in a totally different way. And even like performance artists who comment on, you know, stand-up culture and the role of the comedian, like they're still presenting it to an audience that's aware of that structure.
Right.
The audience isn't there waiting to laugh. Like, you go to a comedy show, if the comedian doesn't make you laugh, you're like, fuck that.
Yeah.
It's really, you know, it's like if the TV show is not good, you turn it off. It's the
right.
same thing. Whereas art, there's more leeway.
Yeah, exactly. And I wonder too, if in that light, if you've had the sense at some point that, you know, in seeing a performance artist do a comedy oriented, or, you know, maybe about stand up, or they're sort of doing stand up, but they don't have the same danger zones, you know, that they would in an actual comedy venue, you know, because it's a performance art. So they don't, you said yourself earlier, you know, you don't necessarily have to arrive at the punchline. If there's something, you know, if there's too big of a crutch there, if in some way,
mm-hmm.
if it's
mm-hmm.
chickening out, you
yeah.
know, like, well, why don't you just go do a stand-up set, you know, do an open mic night.
Right, right. But then that wouldn't be performance art. Performance
True.
Art is specifically commenting on performance.
Right.
As well as performing. But, I mean, there's a comedian I've been like, we hung out the other day, and she has a background in performance art. Her name is Kat Yeary, and she was like, one day we were talking and I was like, oh, you know, you seem to know a lot about art. And we were talking about Miranda July. And she's like, oh, well, you know, I was doing performance art, but then I kept doing stuff that was funny and made people laugh. And someone was like, why don't you just do comedy? You know, and she's like, oh, sounds good. You know, she also has like a theater background. And so that was like, you know, just transitioning. That was like a transition that was possible for her. And
yeah.
I think that's great when that's possible, but maybe that's not something that every performance artist can or wants to do.
Right. Speaking of Miranda July, you reminded me of her character in Me, You, and Everyone We Know. Is that what it's called?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And I feel like that character as a performance artist, there was something about it, the writing, that was both kind of accurate as well as a kind of a parody of the performance at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're definitely right. She does embody that. I mean, it's funny watching that, someone in the art world, and being like, oh, right, like, you know, there's this sort of, like, sad funniness to that scene where she goes home, and she's just like, well, better start my new performance piece. She's making a video, and it's like, okay, I'm going to drop it off at the museum. Just
right.
Like,
I'm going to drop it off. Know, I'm going to drop my video off at the museum. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, how do you even penetrate or like get at all connected to this sort of esoteric art world? It's
right.
You know, comedy, in that respect, comedy, you can just go to a show and talk to someone and, hey, I'm a comedian too. And you just keep showing up and people start noticing you, and then maybe you start doing some open mics, and it's a lot easier to enter.
Yeah.
And all you need is a sense of humor and an ability to form a punchline. Whereas performance, there's this, oh, where'd you get your MFA? And oh, you know, these curators at these institutions that are like, you know, you're hoping one of them will see you, and there's this writer, maybe they'll see you. And it's just like the bar to entry is so much higher, but then once you're in, I feel like you're in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's a much lower bar to entry with comedy, but it takes a long, like, you're like, what does it mean to be in, or like that I get booked on shows, that I might make $100 a week from shows, like, you know, because there's still the issue of making a living.
Yeah.
Even if it's a lower bar to entry.
Right. You just
whereas in art you have to go into so much debt.
Yeah.
Consider.
Well, what you just described sounds like you made fairly clear the pros and cons to both. You know, like that with art, the entry is kind of difficult, and yet when you do get in, you know, you're kind of bitching and moaning about the art world. And with comedy, the entry's much lower, and it's maybe much more communal, and there's more camaraderie. But the realities of succeeding are ultimately maybe more finite and challenging.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and also, like, to know how to even get into, like, I guess you could take, like, a improv class or, like, stand-up. I took a stand-up comedy class that was really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But some people just, you know, you just sort of work it out with your friends, and there are no rules in that way. I mean, but stand-up comedy has gotten a lot more popular than
yeah.
it used to be. I think there's more art world crossover. We're kind of having a moment in this right now. And, yeah, but, I mean, I just remember the first open mic I ever did. You know, I was just like, okay, I was living in Chicago. It was an open mic that Cameron Esposito ran at the time when she was in Chicago. And I knew her from a job where I was kind of her boss.
Wow.
At the Chicago Tribune. And I hired her to write a comedy blog, and it ended up being mostly about her. And I was like, okay. And she commented a bit on like the comedy scene in Chicago. And I went up there and I was like, I had these ideas that I thought were funny in a sad way, because you know, I just gotten fired from this job, and I had like a weird interaction with my roommate. I think it's something about like she was waiting for she got a Valentine's Day gift, and it was from someone that she didn't think it was not from someone she wanted it to be from. It, you know, something that was like, it was funny to me in the moment, and I was like, oh, it's funny that I lost my job, you know, things like that. And I went up there and tried to talk about them, and I was like, oh, this is not funny to others. Like, how do you write this joke? And I didn't realize, like, the stand-up comedian needs to be the hero of the story. Like, you never want the audience to feel bad for you in a serious way.
Right.
You know, they might be like, oh, that's sad. And then it's like, oh, my God, hilarious. You know, you want them you want them to leave satisfied. It's like a gift in that way. You're not going to be like, oh, and here's some shit. Sorry, I did this. And you're just like, oh, get off the stage. You know, you don't want to.
Right.
You want something triumphant to happen to them, or the story to take a twist that is relieving. And I didn't understand any of that. I thought you could just go up there and just tell a story that would be somehow funny because it was funny in my head. So
right.
That must have been exciting first open mic. My roommate taped it because I thought I would be so hilarious, and it was not the case. I was into comedy writing.
Was it traumatic? How bad you bombed, or it seems like you got over it pretty quickly?
I mean, I was surprised. I was just like, wow. I thought because I watched some comedy and edited Cameron's blog, I knew how to write comedy. It's just totally not true.
Yeah.
I mean, I was somewhat traumatized. I think I went back a couple times, and, you know, I think no one had the heart to tell me, like, you got to, like, work on punching those up. Like, those are just, like, thoughts. There's something in there, but you got to, like, work through it a bit more. Like, it's not funny.
Well, let's maybe we should transition over to your piece, How to Win at Tinder.
Sure.
I guess I thought of that when you mentioned the people that you've been dating, some of the entertainment, you know, writers that you found and comedians that you found yourself with. Were those people that you met through Tinder, or not necessarily?
One of them I met on Bumble, who is working on a show that she's not a stand-up comedian, but she's a TV writer now. That's someone who I met on Bumble.
Which is what?
And it was Bumble, which is just like Tinder, but it's like set up for straight people. So the woman has to make the first move after they match with a guy. But for gay people, it's the same as Tinder.
Okay, got it.
Like no one is the guy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I learned more about just comedy writing through her, because she was working on a script for a show that'll be on Hulu sometime, I don't know, probably later this year. And then another person I dated, is a fiction writer, and her book was auctioned for a TV show. So through dating those two women, I just could have heard more about that process, and I was like, oh, okay, Katie was like a, you know, fiction to TV writer making that transition, and Taylor is like improv, some stand-up to TV writing. And the person I'm dating now has no interaction or relationship to entertainment, which is really nice.
Right.
I was like, okay, I got it, you know. I see that it's a very different space to work in as a writer and a creative person. Yeah, so I've had more exposure just through, I guess, the lesbian community in LA than through the art door. Like the lesbian back door, not the art back door to
right.
entertainment.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But what about Tinder, though? I mean, what about Tinder? Yeah. Well, I mean, I think just to sort of cut to the chase, as far as one of the big takeaways from your piece on it and having been on it, is that it's more about the game, is sort of what I got from what you wrote. It's more about the process of playing it and being on it and the weird high, kind of like a video game from that, rather than some kind of in real life end game.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my co-author Eve Pizer and I were thinking about just the mechanics of it and sort of like, how do you even filter out? At the time I was like matching with men and women. And so was she. And yeah, we were both just like, I hadn't dated in a while because a relationship I took some time off after this one really long relationship, and she was just back in New York after she'd graduated from Oberlin, and we were both just like, what is Tinder? And so we wanted to find out, and we wanted to sort of understand more of the like interpersonal dynamics of it, and like, when do you decide to meet up and why, and what if the point isn't to meet up? What if the point is just to chat with someone, and then sort of like resembles that semi-anonymous chat room vibe of like AOL chat rooms back in the day. I was like, do I want to meet someone? How would it even be that this would lead to that? You know, this could lead to anything. This could lead to a new friend, like a hookup, just a coffee. So it just became so fascinating that I was like, a lot of it was I wanted to see if my idea of what it was would be the same as the reality of what it would become after we met or if we didn't meet. So it sort of became this like, I don't know, kind of like this maze. Like I wasn't like, I have to get a girlfriend. I was like, I just want to understand this. It became sort of like a research project, and same with Eve. And since I was only in New York for the summer, I was like, I don't really want to meet someone because I don't really want to, you know, get too emotionally involved with someone when I don't live here, you know, as you do. And I did make a couple of friends from it, but it just became really fascinating to understand what it is. And like, there's an addictive quality to it. There's definitely, you know, you might be having a great conversation and then someone totally drops off. And you're like, okay, that happened to me once where I was like, I thought I was having a great conversation with this girl and she just stopped replying. And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, and that can happen and you don't know why. And just sort of like really detaching from any results that you think you're going to get or have. And so it's like, I felt like it was a practice in detachment, you know, almost like a Buddhist meditation of sorts where you're just like, I have no idea. And then like, how am I okay in that space of, you know, I don't want to blame things on Tinder or not, or, you know, blame things on the people or, you know, try to just play for the fun of it because really that's all you have because you have no idea something could happen. So just like being okay in that space and like letting it be whatever you want it to be and ultimately whatever it is without having a goal in mind. And that piece got picked up, I think at the same time Nancy Jo Sales had written like a really sort of searing expose on like Tinder hookup culture. And I was like, wow, that was not mine and Eve's experience. And she was not writing it as someone who was playing and like actually, you know, involved in the game or like lack thereof game. Mm-hmm. She was like looking at it and just sort of like sensationalizing it, which, you know, I enjoyed the book Bling Ring. I have her book American Girls, but she's sort of known for that, you know, there's a sensationalism and a sort of like, she's very excited about it, but she's not in it. Like she's not experiencing it. So Eve and I were coming at it from a very like experiential and also just like, hey, we're actually using this because this potentially is a place to meet someone, but you get to a point where you're just like, it does, you know, it goes in and out between being like, it's a dating app. Oh, I'm kind of lonely. I'm talking to someone. Oh, it's entertainment. You know, it takes on all these sort of like, if you use it often, it can take on all these like multi uses that, I did not anticipate. And people are people at the end of the day. Like ironically, this lady who's very lovely I'm dating right now, I did meet on Tinder, but she's like the last person I was like, I cannot play this game anymore. And I was like, I matched with her and I gave her my number and then I deleted my account like a day later and I was like, if she doesn't text me, whatever, I just can't do this anymore. I just really sort of burned out and she did end up texting me and we're still seeing each other a couple months later. So
that's tough.
I don't know if it's the death of millennial dating or it's, I try to take a more positive approach. Our second essay, Tinderization of Feeling, was about the sort of like specific like burnout feeling you get from dating apps, you know, specifically like that affect, we called it the Tinderization of feeling. Mm-hmm. And then the last essay, which we are still brainstorming and just sort of discussing, is called How Tinder Was Won, like how the West was won. So that'll happen.
Well, your second one anticipated, or your second one sort of crossed over with what I was, my next question, or what I was thinking, which is whether, and it sounds like you almost kind of answered this, that there's a certain kind of detachment. That detachment turns into sort of an apathy, you know, in the when you're really in that game. And, you know, that's not, it doesn't sound particularly healthy.
No, it's not.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was right on that.
Yeah, it's
do you
awful.
Do you notice
how did I get here?
Yeah, do you notice now that you're, you know, dating somebody in the flesh versus, say, when you were in the heat of Tinder? You know, can you look back in the past and sort of compare the you then with the you now?
I mean, I felt like I did. There was a period of playing Tinder where, like, I gave a lot of people a lot of attention and really maybe over emotionally engaged before. So that was just like bad boundaries, which I've worked on since. I think the one thing I've really worked on since is boundaries. You know, and you have to have boundaries in whether or not you're on an app, you know? So I guess the thing I've been learning more about lately is just emotional boundaries with people in person, not just on apps.
Yeah.
Trust and feelings and I mean, you know, it's like dating and a relationship both have the quality of like, oh, if you know, you got to keep showing up. Like, you do have to keep playing if you know, think this is a place where you might actually meet someone. You know, if you do want a relationship to work out, you do have to keep showing up to it. So Maria has a funny joke about that where it starts off with, you know, the one thing that I really wanted was to become successful in comedy and to become a comedian. And, you know, so it kept showing up, it kept showing up. And, you know, people ask, you know, that's a common question that she used to ask. And now she gets, you know, how do you make it in show business?
Right.
And, you know, do you dress up as a bush and pop from San Diego back to Los Angeles and put yourself out there? Like, how do you do it? You know, and the answer is, oh, well, do you like what you're doing? Well, yeah. Well, you know, then just keep doing it, you know? And it's like, okay. She's like, but is that the same as a relationship? Like, you know, how do you make a relationship work? How do you even get into one? Were you like standing in a garden and then your hands met and then you saw love and it was just bliss after that? And, you know, so she started asking people like, how do you have that? And they said, oh, you know, well, we met and, you know, we liked each other. So we just kept seeing each other, you know, just keep showing up. I was like, oh, that's it. Like, it is like show, making it in show business. You just keep showing up, you know, it's like anything. So I think that applies to dating. Like, you just keep trying it out. So I don't know. I guess the main difference, to answer your question, might be just that now I've gotten to learn more about this in person rather than just on an app. So it's been like a slow build, like emotional boundaries. And
when you say this, you mean the relationship? You learn more about this?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas when
so
you're on Tinder,
it's
you're not
about winning and losing.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, but you don't want to play a relationship like a game.
No.
I mean, that would not bode very well for a relationship.
No. No.
So it's like the opposite of a game. So maybe now I'm doing the opposite sort of learning as I did when I was on Tinder.
Yeah. Well, as much as I'd like to tie your experience with Tinder back to art, I don't necessarily think we have to, and I think it would be too much of a stretch if we did. So we'll just end there, if that's all right with you.
That sounds great.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Yes, it was lovely to talk with you too, Michael.
Absolutely. And we're out. Thank you very much again to Alicia for coming on the show. Thank you very much for listening. I would love to hear what you think about this episode. If you appreciate the art adjacent topics, have any questions, thoughts, were provoked, what have you. Always love to hear from you. Of course, you can follow the show on social media at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter. You can like the show on Facebook. We're getting close to a pretty landmark number there. And if you happen to hit that landmark, once again, St. Kitts could be yours in the near future. And your support is very much appreciated financially. If you could donate to the show, it would be fantastic. Always love seeing those emails saying you have received a donation. Just got one the other day, which I really appreciate. That person will be getting a shout out probably in the next episode. And you can do that by going to theconversationpod.com/support. What else? What do we have coming up? We have some very exciting episodes coming up in the near future. I am brainstorming a second sister podcast. So don't want to get too ahead of myself, but just FYI, that is in the conceptual works. And I think that's about it for now. I really appreciate your being here. I look forward to hearing from you and letting me know what you think of our conversation today, tonight, this morning, this afternoon. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.